This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle, Dr. with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. Today we have a special treat for our listeners, and that special treat is we are welcoming Dr. Jen Hawk to the show, and we're going to interview her and ask her some questions today. Dr. Lyle, would you like to say something?
Harvard.
Oh my God.
Harvard is...
I am more than just my alma mater.
The old joke is that when you graduate from Harvard, the hardest thing to do is that first minute in a conversation when you're trying to get it into the conversation. That's the hardest stretch you got for the rest of your life. So I figured I'd spare you the stress, Jen.
I really appreciate that. That's really, really big of you. I struggle mightily with this problem. So
Dr. Jennifer Hawk is a brilliant political science PhD from Harvard University, and she's my colleague. We work at True North Health together, and it's been an enormously enjoyable and fabulous ride this last. How long have you been with us now? About a year and a half?
Just over a year. It was May of last year. So yeah. Yeah. Just over
well, this here. Is, this has been an extraordinary ride for me. Never had a colleague that brought so much to the table to help me increase my clarity on my own thinking and really shed a lot of light in the corners of human psychology. So obviously political science, what are those things that are the two words that go together that are oxymoron? Is that what that is?
Well, political scientists are really just bad economists, so they had to come up with a different name to call themselves to sound fancy. But yes, we're scientists in only the very loosest sense of the term.
Anyway, the
and
point
actually,
is,
Harvard calls it government. So technically, my PhD is in government; it's not in political science. So,
oh God,
yes.
That's even worse.
Oh yes, I'm very fancy.
So, but anyway, the whole point is that it's social science, and so we actually discovered over the last couple of years that we shared a lot of common information and common understanding of what our backgrounds were, but there was a lot of places where they diverged. And where they diverged, I think we found it to be, you know, entertaining where our own fields were incredibly ignorant of the other, and also fascinating where we learned. And so I think you'd probably agree with that, Jen.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's. I think you said at some point we're sort of 13 degrees off of each other in how
yes.
we see the world and the different backgrounds that we bring to any particular puzzle. So it can be very interesting and sometimes very vexing.
That'll come up soon enough. Yeah. So anyway, we're going to have great fun, and I'm sure listeners will enjoy having some estrogen as part of the discussions around here. So
yes.
Anyway, let's.
It's truly an honor to be here on the Mansplainer Power Hour.
Oh my God! We may have to look at our contract with her again pretty soon. We may have to rethink this thing already. All right, so let's roll, Nathan. Let's take some questions and see what comes up.
All right, fantastic. Well, looking forward to it. Today's topic is about male-female dynamics with regards to dating and other things. So, right on time. All right, dear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk. I'm curious how our esteem meter responds when we have someone sending us rejection signals or trying to reduce our status because they are envious or intimidated by our status. I'm trying to figure out how not to let those friendships or new acquaintances not impact my esteem meter when I likely can understand it's coming from a place of their own insecurity and competitiveness. I wish my esteem was mostly impacted by close relationships, but I feel saddened when meeting a new group of women and feeling as though I don't fit in because I may be more competitive than they are. How do I not let it affect me?
Well, this is a great question for Jen, because I think that she's obviously been in that situation and has seen it and at closer range than I would have. But yeah, Jen, just give us some thoughts on that, and where do you go with that?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is that the esteem meter is never broken, and you can't rewrite how you're interpreting the situation. In other words, if the cost benefit is there and you're getting feedback from the village that is relevant to your competitive experience, that feedback is probably valid to one degree or another, whether those people are acquaintances or whether they're motivated by jealousy or whether they're close friends or not. So if you have self-talk, it doesn't really matter who it's coming from. It's still giving you very valuable information about your competitive status. So that's just my first take on it. I am trying to parse the question a little bit with the piece of you're not fitting in because you're more competitive than they are. I would bring a little skepticism to that question. I don't know what Dr. Lyle would say about that, but I don't think you're going to feel bad about that situation necessarily because you are bringing a more, you're bringing a stronger competition to the game.
No. Yeah, I think the, I'm not exactly sure where the bad feelings come, possibly because that maybe they're feeling rejected and being pushed out of the coalition a little bit,
the rejection signals coming from the friends, or are they coming from potential mates in this question?
I think what they're getting is, this is what I think that they're describing. I think they're describing that they're getting essentially frustration slash rejection signals from these friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the bad feelings are probably a little bit, possibly a little bit hard to pin down where the source is. So some of it could come from the fact that you know that the friends are envious. And so mm-hmm. If you have some degree of empathy for their situation, possibly. Mm-hmm. Also, the bad feelings can be coming from feeling rejected. That is also the case. So there could be sort of a mishmash of negative feelings that would be coming from, i.e., a strain in the girl, you know, the girl mm-hmm. world.
The girl code.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And so let's hypothesize that you've got a situation, because this sounds like somebody's talking about like a new group, and there's a new group of people, and there's some new women, and they're picking up these signals. What would you be sort of telling them or explaining to them about how to manage this?
Yeah, so I think that women are very, very dependent on each other for signals about, in the mating arena, who is most valuable. So women are going to be tuned into the feedback from other women about how competitive they are with regard to the same pool of men. So if we're dealing with new friends, there's a process of initial calibration that's going on where they're sort of interacting with new people. Everyone's trying to figure out how they fit in any given hierarchy. But women are playing kind of a dual game in a certain way, because they're obviously trying to remain as competitive as they can in the mating arena, but they're trying to preserve these female friendships, which are fraught with peril when you're all kind of competing for the same men. So I think this is a fairly normal situation that women are going to find themselves in, and it's going to be subject to more volatility when the relationships are new and there's not a lot of basis for the friendship already, and people are trying to plug themselves into that village hierarchy with not a whole lot of information.
Yeah, and bitches, just like I said.
hold on just a second. Yeah, that's the toxic masculinity alarm.
God, that's beautiful. No, but the
I reserve the right to play that alarm anytime that that happens.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense, in that these relationships have dual motivations, and therefore it gets tricky. And if you're a sensitive kind of a person, if you're reasonably agreeable and you're walking into a situation where you're starting to pick up signals that they feel threatened, you know, this is it's uncomfortable. And let's face it, sometimes you're not going to fit.
Right. Okay, and it's a trade-off. Yeah. I mean, which competitive arena is more important? Like, sometimes there's just inherent conflicts of interest here. And if you want to be maximally competitive, finding the best possible mate you can find, maybe you're the bitch among some new acquaintances. And that's just the way that it is.
And also true that this is, to some degree, there's, I don't know that anybody has data on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if this were true. And that is that, I mean, to some degree, there's going to be multiple reasons why this would be true. But I think that you're going to have, I remember reading in Bus and Bus meandering some thought around this issue, I believe. And that is certainly highly attractive women are going to tend to have highly attractive women friends to the extent that they've got them. Except that if a girl is tough enough and stable enough psychologically, that she might be 20 percentile, you know, less than her much more attractive friend, and grit her teeth and basically play wing person, so that she can gather the droppings of the one that the friend doesn't take.
Ugly friend syndrome is real.
What's that?
The ugly friend syndrome is real. Yeah.
But I wouldn't say, for example, ugly wouldn't make sense.
No, not so, ugly. Obviously, right. No. This is a relative standing kind of situation.
I will bet you that it's not. I'll bet you there's. If somebody had the evidence, I'll bet you that essentially we're going to find some stress when the delta between two women, for example, or in a crowd of four or five of them, becomes too great. So 9 and 7 is fine, okay? And yet 9 to 5 is going to be a problem, because the sevens gain value potentially from hanging with the nines, because the nines are going to draw in highly attractive males, and then the males may have to get bait and switched to the seven.
Well, and everybody is playing casual mating in this scenario anyway, most likely, if you're out at a bar or whatever.
Yes.
So it almost doesn't matter, because the more attractive men are happy to scale down for the night.
Yeah, so this is all getting really interesting. So anyway, let's move on. But that's an interesting question, and we've now introduced the nimble mind of Jen Hawk to our audience, which is just fabulous. All right, let's roll on, Nathan.
All right. So if women marry for genes and resources, but men only for genes, what about all of the men in history that one reads about with few resources who married heiresses, etc.? I think we can safely assume Chippy's on the side, but it's pretty clear when careers only take off after a well-connected or wealthy marriage that they did marry, at least in part, for those resources. I get it that resources are to allow them more casual mating, but they still were attracted, at least in part, to the female mate for those resources. What do you think?
Of course they were.
Go ahead and take your first pass, Jen, and then I'll fill in anything else. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this is a situational condition. If the female has more resources, the evaluation of the so-called pair bond in this situation, which is a quasi pair bond if you've got all kinds of chippies on the side anyway, this sounds like, the way this question is worded strikes me as a very strategic alliance between between a man and a woman, a man who might be under rewarded on looks, but, you know, is making up for it in other ways. And this is going to be common throughout history in various, very specific situations. You're not going to see it as much today because men have more choice in that way, and women have more access to resources. So, but I would say that the evaluation of any mating relationship is not just being conducted on the level of appearance. There's obviously other things that are going into that equation, and you're going to see situations where a woman's wealth, an heiress, or, you know, especially if she's can be bamboozled out of it in one way or another. There's some fine cinema along these lines, gaslight among them, that it's obviously it's going to present itself as a pretty good deal to the right kind of disagreeable predatory male.
So it didn't take her long to get that description in there.
Yeah. My answers are less meandering than Dr. Lyle's, but, yeah. You know, if the answer is a predatory male, the answer is a predatory male.
All right. Well, when I look at this question, I want to like draw us back to understand that again, what Jen's certainly referring to is that the CB can be an odd-looking CB in history, but wouldn't have been an odd-looking CB in prehistory. So if we go back and try to understand female behavior in general before there was wealth, then it all makes perfect sense. And the women didn't have any wealth, so the men weren't making these trades. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that some disagreeable, predatory, lazy, etc., or otherwise, you know, you could see this was a subplot of Sense and Sensibility by Jane Austen, mm-hmm. where there was a pair that was clearly in love, and I forget their names, but I remember reading it thinking, oh, this is going to be another essentially Pride and Prejudice great love story, and then it falls apart, and I was a little bit. I remember reading this, you know, as a high school kid, and feeling crestfallen and really kind of upset about it. And the reason is that Pride and Prejudice was this great heroic love story. And so I was expecting something similar in the next book. And instead, I find really naturalistic literature instead of romantic heroic literature. It's naturalistic literature where the guy, who they clearly had great chemistry, but he, you know, likes his dogs and has some financial problems, perhaps, and so he marries some stylishly dressed heiress and dumps the heroine who was vastly more interesting and that he was clearly smitten with, and that kind of made me a little sick as a 15-year-old kid, and so, you know, there are circumstances throughout history. Up until the present day, where some male is willing to sell out, or needs to, or just, you know, for whatever constellation of reasons, he does make a strategic choice there, rather than going with essentially Stone Age instincts. And so, of course, that can happen, and it's lousy. I mean, I've seen it happen. I've seen it right in front of me, and it's kind of in the modern world. I kind of shake my head in some serious disgust, and I also look at the female like, what the hell are you doing? Like, why, you know, where's the narcissism in here? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, where is this that you think you rate for this and you clearly don't? Yeah.
Most of the time she's just chugging along believing that she rates that way. You know, that is, it's that the narcissism part of that equation is not to be denied, because women that are getting themselves in this situation are not feeling the stress of being under rewarded to a significant degree. And that requires a fair amount of narcissism in the system to sustain. But I think the reason that you see this is kind of a recurring theme in literature and movies. Like, a lot of dramatic tension turns on these kinds of deals. Like, I'm thinking, I just recently watched Match Point again, a few months ago, which is, you know, also like it's basically the story of crime and punishment. These are like classic literary themes. And I think it's because this is an inherent bad deal. It's a bad trade. There's tension and conflict just built into this whole arrangement because everybody knows that it's rotten to the core, but it's expedient. And so it's this large cinematic question of how do you reconcile these two things? And usually, you know, spoiler, it doesn't turn out too well.
Yeah.
So these relationships don't usually end up happily ever after unless they, you know, there are particular circumstances that can contribute to that, which I'm sure has happened, but
rare.
It's not a good strategy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a question here because the beginning, I might just be being a little nitpicky, but the question starts out if women marry for genes and resources. From what I understand is women marry for genes also, but just they count resources as part of the genetic picture more so than men do.
Yes, probably that's true, but I would say that that really what women are doing when they're what we're interested in here and what we're actually talking about, there's two different discussions here. One of them is what people will do, and the other the discussion is what is human romance and its ultimate fulfillment. Mm-hmm. Two entirely different mm-hmm. questions. Okay, mm-hmm. So people will do all kinds of wacky, lazy, shortcut, deceptive shit. Okay, that doesn't surprise anybody. Okay, so
yeah.
I'm not
normal.
Yeah, I'm not too interested in that. I'm more interested in, you know, what are the contours and the sort of reaction ranges to how things can work as people. You know, where do romance? Where does it really come together, and under what conditions? And so a major condition that's inside the female brain isn't so much how much money does a guy have, but rather what is his potential?
Right.
And so it's what is his total resource? Actually, there's a name for it. We call it resource holding potential. Can he take the territory? Will he get food? Will he protect me? Will he protect our kid? In other words, so it's essentially we're kind of sizing him up as a female. You're sizing him up on what would this guy be like on a desert island? Okay, is really kind of the what's really firing the romantic chips inside of a female brain. The rest of it is highly strategic and doesn't. It may tell us a great deal about why females do what they do in the modern environment, but it's not telling us about their romantic fulfillment. I think those are two different things.
So Dr. Hawk, would you say you're a very sophisticated venture capitalist? Is that basically?
No comment. Right. You're walking the line of the toxic masculinity alarm.
I want to get that button.
There it is. Oh, God.
Right. Actually, really, the true toxic masculinity alarm would be this one.
Oh man!
I'll work my way up to it.
That's right. All right.
You know, woman in the modern environment just has to walk around with these kind of alarms at all times because you just never know what you're going to encounter. So it's like, yeah, consider that some free dating advice. Goes over really well on a Tinder date.
Oh my.
Well,
all right.
Perfect timing because our next question, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, is about bad boys. So,
yeah, wait a second. So right away we find Dr. Hawk's coming first already. I see.
It's alphabetically it comes first.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
It's only fair. Yeah.
All right.
Dear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, some women seem to want to fix bad boys. Is this just their hope that he will pair bond with them? And is this just a fantasy?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I don't even know where to start with this one. So yes, it's just a fantasy. First of all, you can't change anybody. So Dr. Lyle has addressed this at great length on former podcasts in terms of how intractable genetically determined personality is. So you've got a bad boy. He's a bad boy. He's just going to be a bad boy. He was born that way. This is who this person is. women have a lot of sort of traditional wisdom about this. But in the other sense, you know, if he's a bad boy and you're trying to fix him, that's probably telling you that you're over rewarded too. I mean, if you're in this dynamic and you're you feel like it's a fixer upper and you can't keep track of him and he's cheating on you and he is not coming home to you at night, like, this is just somebody who you're not qualifying for one way or another. So you can't generally fix that dynamic. You can't fix their personality. You can't hope that somebody that you've ensnared with a casual mating strategy is suddenly going to want to pair bond with you because they discover what a wonderful person you are inside. Like, none of this works. Cut your losses early and often and move on to the next one.
Yeah.
Go find yourself a Horace.
Horace. Yeah.
Step away from the Jimmies.
Yeah. I would also add the following, and that is that you're battling a hypothesized instinct inside the female mind.
Oh, yeah. this instinct.
Yes.
This is bad news, ladies.
Yeah, you forget about this one. It shows how well hidden it is.
I don't forget it. I suppress it.
Yeah. So I believe, and this, I didn't make this up, but I can't point to the page in David Buss's work or elsewhere, wherever this came to my attention. But it makes complete sense from an evolutionary point of view. That the, and actually, obviously, the evidence, there's actually quite a lot of evidence that points towards this. So the fact that females prefer rounder faced males when they are not fertile, and then as they reach and then as they reach their fertility peak during a month, the faces get that they prefer get squarer and more testosteronized. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So
badder boys.
Oops, that's my phone going off. The fact that this is true, that this is in fact how the female sexual psychology or aesthetic, you know, obviously attraction psychology is built, that tells us something very interesting. And that is that it would make sense, obviously this was a guidance, feelings are guidance systems for decision making, and those are decision making systems or preferences were optimal for Stone Age conditions. That's why they're the instincts that we have. And so, if a female is more attracted to, and interestingly enough, more attracted to wanting to be near and, quote, loving towards a round-faced female or round-faced male, but not sexual, mm-hmm. okay? And then she becomes increasingly sexually alive and excited towards when she's at her peak fertility point. And the the mating search image that she has in her head is a more masculinized male, then that would tell us, we're looking back through, these are shadows of forgotten ancestors. This is telling us the evolutionary design and the behavior that took place and was successful in our species history. So the female basically has a strong predilection to getting resources out of the nice guy through the 2/3 of the month when she's not fertile, and then screwing the bad boy, and then who is not going to be around. And so that this now tells us that the female mind is a house divided. And so this is what mm-hmm. fixing a bad boy is you actually are attracted to people who are going to cheat on you and are going to sleep around, because the very fact is that those are highly successful genes that are getting harvesting a lot of female DNA with very little cost. So if you
so romantic
and
harvesting female DNA, yeah. It's like the Matrix up in here.
Well, it just comes out that way. Sorry. So anyway. The point is that therefore what you have is probably essentially a strong instinct that is inherently attracted to people who are not pair bond material that by psychology. Mm-hmm. And so this is the fixing of the bad boy. The fixing of the bad boy is obviously a pipe dream that we can get the fantastically sexually successful DNA into my son that is going to be a little just heartbreaker Casanova in the next generation and leave me 250 grandchildren. that we're going to have that, but at the same time, somehow we're going to maneuver this guy, this particular Casanova, into your nest, and he's going to provide and be faithful. Well, this is obviously
never going to happen.
And so, so obviously, this is a female. Female is designed to take those kinds of risks, and to keep in mind, average female is obviously not built for such a stark contrast. I want you to imagine that one stop short of the most masculine male that she finds the most attractive is actually the guy who's a little bit less masculine and a little bit nicer. Okay. Well, now the probability just went up by a few percent that he will stick around. So you start to see that the real female psychology is not just working this contrast effect between the two males, but is looking for a contrast of two different sides to the male personality within the same male.
Good luck with that.
That's exactly. But that is what fixing a bad boy is. Okay.
So that's sort of the long answer,
complete with some toxic masculinity in there about how this works.
The toxic masculinity veiled by science is okay. It's just when you get personal about it. Yeah. Well, this is also, I mean, that scenario, the way that plays out, that you've got the nice little pair bonder at home, and then you're going and cheating on him and getting knocked up by the bad boy, but the pair bonder is the sucker who's raising the kid for you, raising him for the bad boy. Yeah. I mean, I think this is why anecdotally women have the experience that men are much more sensitive to being cheated on than women are, because women will come down to the, they're not happy about it, but as long as he's coming home to me, that's what you'll hear again and again and again, whereas men first time you cheat on them very often are out the door. There's no second chance because of this ancestral instinct that that's not my kid. Yeah, you're putting my eggs at risk there,
right? Absolutely yeah. True. And so this contributes to the tolerance for the bad boy behavior. Mm-hmm. Is exactly this
the shenanigans.
No question. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
Very
so
good.
I've got a question about this. So if a female understands her own psychology, she, of course, can try to beat her genes and, like you said, suppress this emotion. If a potential Horus understands female psychology, what is his incentive to try to date women if he will never quite know if she's doing the two-thirds for him and then one-third she's kind of looking at the other side?
Oh. Well, being Horace myself, I can answer this question.
Thank God we have Horace in the house.
The truth is that this is a lot about what sort of this pair bonding experience is and the sensitivity to all the esteem signals that go on in a romance. So even if you're Horace, that doesn't mean you don't qualify. It just means that your woman may be periodically very interested in other people, but that doesn't mean that she's going to take action on that. And it also doesn't mean that if she does take action on it, that she's going to wind up pregnant. So in other words, these are probability issues. So if you're Horace, you are trying to get into a relationship with someone that you find sufficiently attractive that you feel like it's worth it for you to put all your eggs in that basket and to commit, okay? And remember, Horace-ness versus Jimmy-ness is a
continuum.
Right, it's a relative experience inside the male brain depending upon the female that's in front of him. So a round-faced Horace without any game at all. The point is that if it turns out that he gets into a situation where the female that he feels is beneath him, suddenly he's got a little Casanova check comes alive. So these are context dependent, circuits. That's how this works. Yeah.
Hmm.
There you go.
Yeah. What a shit show.
Dr. Hawk, can we get more commentary from you?
No, let's go on to another question. I close this out.
Oh, I see. You decide when we're done talking about male-female dynamics. That's not very Horus of you.
Oh, my God. No, please, like, if you have anything else that occurs to you, of course, go ahead.
No, we can move on. It's all right. It's best not to lament.
Yes. All right. On we go.
Too much.
Length. All right. Dear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, I am a 46-year-old woman and have been out of the dating scene for 20 years. So the question is, how do I calibrate my chances for dating different types of men? How desirable of a man do I qualify for? Are there ways of figuring this out without having to do a lot of dating?
Have at it, Jen.
Well, my first pass at that question is that you can't really figure it out without doing a lot of dating. You can in principle sort of look, you can do some, you know, some sleuthing with your female friends, and you can try to sort of look at women that would be competitive with you, and you can look at who they qualify for, and you can plug it all into your little computer and make some calculations and make some estimates. But fundamentally, you don't really know until you actually go out there and confront the competitive reality in front of you. And this doesn't have to be a big deal. This is, you know, very, very low cost process as far as all of the apps now. So you can go gather a lot of data in a short period of time via Tinder or Match or any of the online sites that are going to give you some very quick feedback, and you're going to be able to figure it out pretty quickly. I would caution women against, and someone who's writing this question into the show might already be aware of this, but that the feedback you're getting from men at a bar, if you're offering up casual mating strategy, is not accurate calibration feedback for who you would qualify for a pair bond. So that it's not, you're not fishing for the same standard of mate if you're offering casual mating strategy too quickly. This is what 10 paid dates is all about. The only way to truly find out what kind of pair bond you would qualify for is to go get some data in real life and play 10 paid dates or more. That would be my take on that.
Yeah, very good. The great Karnak will now speak.
I said your name first, Dr. Lyle.
He's going to great effort to give you all kinds of status. Who knew the great Dr. Lyle was so status deficient?
The great Karnak is getting a sense from the writer of this, and is getting a sense that I now have a message for her. Here it comes.
Oh, I think, yeah, I'm getting it too.
Here it comes. You're going to be disappointed.
Yes, it's exactly what I saw in my crystal ball. So this is absolutely has to be true. I believe the moon is in Cancer
right now.
That's
it. Yeah, such is life.
And, yeah, lower your expectations. You're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yes, this is probably the
probably what's going to happen, and also probably the, as we've talked about many times here, that the solution to the disappointment, now that's, who knows, we have no idea what this person's personal experience will be and how they're built. However, it's likely that they're going to be disappointed, and that it's likely that the ultimate solution is going to be giving people that you're not that wild about at first meeting repeat exposures. See if you shift.
It's actually the most important piece of advice that women need to really understand is that, and all women have had this.
No, you go right ahead.
I'm interrupting you, Dr. Lyle. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That I think all women have had this experience, you know, a few times in their life where they've not, you know, not been interested in someone, and then they get to know that person and their character and their personality and their humor and everything else, and suddenly it's like a little bell goes off above their head, and they're like, oh, I never thought about them that way before. And so this is the repeat exposure effect. And most women have some experience with it. And the idea is that if you're putting yourself out there and you're calibrating, if you're attracted right out of the gate, if you're super attracted right out of the gate to someone you met on Tinder, it's almost a certainty that you do not qualify for that person for a pair bond because you are over-rewarded. Almost always. Not necessarily, but it's should be, it should raise a little flag in your dating mind that that's probably the situation, and they are probably going to be playing casual mating strategy on you, and they might be very deceptive about it. So this is why we need to be playing 10 paid dates and everything else. But the repeat exposure effect is a real effect. It's something that men are not experiencing in the same way that women are experiencing it. But women really can, if they stick it out and they give this guy a few chances, even when they really don't think that they'd be interested. Obviously, there are reasons to toss him out back into the water early on and not give him more chances. If the guy can't put a sentence together in the email that he sends you on Tinder, or if he's, you know, really is completely obnoxious on the first date, you don't need to grit your teeth and, you know, bear a few more repeat exposures just to find out. But if you, any part of you thinks, you know, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with him, you just don't find him that tremendously attractive, give yourself the gift of a few more dates with that person and see if repeat exposure starts to take root in your fickle little mind.
You said it.
So, Dr. Hawk.
All right.
So, Dr. Hawk, you've mentioned a couple of times on Tinder, whereas Dr. Lyle on our show has mentioned a lot about Match.com.
He's old.
So what are your lists? We've got Tinder, we've got Match.com. Any others that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Oh, I wouldn't recommend any of them in particular. Yeah, I mean, it depends on what your goals are, obviously. I mean, Tinder and I think your initial cut with these things should be how much investment is the male making to even be on that site. So at least on Match.com, he has to pay a fee to be there. So there's some sort of investment happening, which is indicating that he is at least somewhat above the fray as far as a potential pair bond. But if you don't care about that and you're just in a casual mating game, then have at it on Tinder. It's a free-for-all, as are all the other little swipe apps and all the apps that have copied that model. But if you're really serious about it, you can also look into their actual, there's been a resurgence of real live matchmakers lately that will, you know, try to pair you up with somebody that they find very suitable. And that's an even higher threshold of male investment to even be there and to go out on the first date. So all of these things are, it just really depends on what you're looking for, what your goals are, how old you are, what you want. It's all very specific to the lady in question.
It would be fun, just like Jeffrey Miller did a study on the bumper stickers and the different personalities.
Yes.
I wonder if someone could do a personality for the different dating sites as well. Because I think, I've talked with friends saying Tinder might be the lower conscientious fruit, and okay, Cupid is sometimes referred to as okay, stupid. You know, I mean, it's just...
Oh, poor okay, Cupid. Okay, Cupid had a real heyday back when it was run by a bunch of nerds from MIT, where there were some really interesting quizzes and the match data meant something. But yeah, now it's just copied Tinder and it's on the same model. So these first impression apps where there's no such thing as repeat exposure, and women are playing it wrong because they're only swiping whichever way yes is. This is where I betray the fact that I'm actually not on Tinder. Got left Tinder long ago. But they're only voting yes on men that they immediately find quite attractive, and those men have, you know, the absolute pick of the litter. So it's unlikely that they're going to qualify for any of them. Whereas the men are most likely swiping yes on everybody, so then they can exercise a little bit of discretion once they actually have a match, if any discretion at all. So that's the correct way for
theory,
a male
like
to
it.
Be playing
yes.
those kind of it's all very game theoretical. And so women, you know if they're really going to be serious about trying to find a pair bond on Tinder, go ahead and swipe yes on everybody just like the men are swiping yes on everybody, and wait to see after you match how he actually approaches you, how he initiates the conversation. Go out on a date and then start playing 10 paid dates and see what happens. But obviously this is requires a high threshold of dating pain for any woman that would be playing this game. So it's going to, again, depend on her goals and where she's at in life.
All good.
All right. So our next question for both of the doctors here. I'm so sad to hear. I'm so sad to hear that a woman only gets to mate with a guy that is her age peer or older. I've been so happy to slowly find and adopt the whole food plant-based lifestyle. It's been a challenging journey at times, but one change at a time. I have lost a bunch of unneeded weight and reversed many health conditions. I look and feel better now in my 50s than I did in my 30s. However, sadly, my husband is just not interested. Or should I say he is highly resistant. I estimate his personality to be less than 50th percentile for... Oh,
in her or in the diet?
We're not
sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So I estimate his personality to be less than 50th percentile for openness, conscientiousness, and extroversion. And yes, I would say he's a bit disagreeable. But I found that actually very useful. I'm highly agreeable, and having a disagreeable mate has protected me many times. However, I anticipate that I might outlive him by 20 to 40 years. I need a disagreeable mate to feel protected in the world. But disagreeable men don't want to change their eating and live a long time with me. Arg. I would estimate myself to be open, conscientious, introverted, and agreeable. My introversion makes mate seeking very challenging. If I outlive my husband, am I just going to have to be lonely? I told him he should make a plan for my next mate so that I don't have to after he dies. However, if I get nice and old, there will not be any men older than me left. Won't some young, disagreeable male protector show up for me?
book an hour with Dr. Jen Hawk.
I can't rule out the possibility that we're being trolled by this question. And the message in the crystal ball for this one is that, yeah, you're not happy with your husband either way. Like, this is not a happy marriage. I can't quite tell all of the dynamics that are happening here, but you're not going to outlive him by 20 to 40 years. Dr. Lyle can give you quite the takedown on the difference between living a perfectly adherent whole food plant-based lifestyle versus having a Philly cheesesteak gripped in each of your sweaty hands with a bottle of gin between your legs. And the difference is only going to buy you a couple of years on average. So this is not, we're not talking about decades of difference of lifespan here. So that seems to me to be a smokescreen for the real core issue that this woman's experiencing, which is that her mate, who she's not describing in particularly glowing terms in any way. I mean, what does she say? She's less than 50th percentile for conscientiousness and openness, and he's also disagreeable. Like, this does not sound like a pleasant mate, and she doesn't sound very happy with him. So we'd have to talk to her and find out like what's really going on. But I think she's rather than spinning around her disagreeable protector, she needs to deal with the relationship that's in front of her and figuring out a way to manage that.
I think she's extremely reasonable that her husband should be figuring out how making a plan her next mate. I mean, I like that.
You're right. You're right. I'm sorry. I take it all back. You're right, Dr. Lyle.
Yeah.
Sure. Entirely reasonable.
George Clooney.
Entirely fair.
With an edge. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. He's too old. He's too old. Yeah. Her young protector needs. Yeah. Even Brad Pitt's too old. He's in his 50s. So, you know, no, we need one of these young Hollywood types.
There you go.
Yeah.
Totally reasonable.
Entirely fair. Entirely reasonable. There we go. Yeah, we fixed it. We fixed the situation. Go tell your husband we said so.
Okay. All right. Do we have time for another one?
How are we doing? Oh, yeah. We've got... Oh, well, we can end here, and then we can get some more on the other end.
Very good.
All right. Well, Dr. Hawk, it's been a pleasure to have...
Oh, is it over?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was great.
Fabulous.
Wonderful to have you on for the first time here, and we are looking forward to having you back many, many more times.
Oh,
grand.
Anytime.
All right, we'll see y'all soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.